This is the Political Ecology Forum podcast at the Norwegian University of Life Sciences. I am your host, Carmen Mappis, PhD candidate at the Department of Urban and Regional Planning.
Today we are here with Arturo Escobar. Arturo Escobar is a professor of anthropology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and a very well-known scholar for many of us. You have been working across fields as social anthropology, international development, and political ecology. And Arturo, welcome to this podcast. Could you tell us a little bit about how you first encountered political ecology and became interested in this field?
Yes, well, first, thanks very much, Carmen, for the interview, and also to John and your professors who are organizing the podcast series. And well, it is a pleasure to be here with you and with everybody who might be listening later on. And maybe let me start by saying that my formal interest in environmental issues started in the early 1980s, late 70s, early 80s, when I was a PhD student at UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. I became a TA, a teaching assistant, for the course that was the introductory course to the major that was called Conservation and Resource Studies. This major was the major that attracted all the young people at Berkeley who were interested in environmental issues. This was before the heyday of environmentalism that would come a little bit later. But there was a bunch of people, really wonderful students that I had. And I was a TA for this class for about 3 or 4 years. And the class had 3 quarters. Berkeley was still in the quarter system, then shifted to semester system. The first quarter was called Global Environmental Problems. The second was an introduction to ecosystems ecology from the biological perspective and ecological perspective. And the third one was called San Francisco Bay Ecosystems. Oh. And that was great. That was my favorite because I learned so much about the San Francisco Bay, the history of the bay. Ecological history, debate, the problems, including the water problem that is still really acute, even more acute today. So that was the first moment. The second moment was when doing my PhD dissertation, again, early 80s to late 80s, I came across the notion of sustainable development. People might remember that 1987 was the publication of the so-called Brundtland Report.
Yes.
From the Norwegian Prime Minister, Gro Harlem Brundtland.
Yeah.
And that launched the sustainable development movement worldwide. And it was a wonderful intervention in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. But in my view, it was problematic because it continued with the same development discourse that I was trying to deconstruct in my dissertation. So I devoted a chapter in the dissertation and then in the book that came out of that, to examining critically how peasants, women, and the environment had become the new objects of study for development and the new objects of the development discourse. I wouldn't say, I mean, that was already political ecology, but it wasn't explicitly political ecology.
Yeah.
But the third moment for me, when I became more explicitly working in the field of political ecology, came after my PhD when I went back to Colombia to do a different kind of research in the Pacific rainforest region of Colombia was undergoing a beginning of massive development programs to develop this region. And I found 2 important social facts. The first social fact was a very strong Black movement that was beginning to happen, to develop as a response to the intrusion of development into the rainforest regions and the river communities. But the second one was that the Pacific rainforest region was becoming very well known worldwide as a hotspot of biodiversity. So it was the beginning of biodiversity conservation and so forth. So out of that came this book, Territories of Difference.
Yeah.
It only came out in 2008 in English and Spanish. But the book was, most of the book was written in the early, late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
And the book, I organized the book in a way as an introduction to political ecology in terms of six concepts. And the concepts were, let me see if I remember, place, capital, development, nature, identity, and networks.
Oh, okay.
And what I tried to do in that book was a political ecology that was a conversation between academic theories and knowledge around those six concepts, mm-hmm. on the one hand, and on the other hand, the social movement understanding and use and their own concepts related to these six things that I mentioned. So yeah. That was a political ecology that for me was kind of exciting. It was already late 90s, 2000s. There was a boom. Political ecology was booming then.
Yes.
And I began to incorporate also the anthropological critique of the understanding of nature, the separation mm-hmm. between nature and culture. And yeah. I would say today, to conclude this first question, that I think in my view, many people point to three different phases in political ecology. The first phase was in the 70s and 80s, when the framework of cultural ecology in geography and anthropology was merged with the concerns of political economy, especially the capitalization of nature, the social production of nature. And that produced the first political ecology one, let's call it that way. Political ecology two came when culture and discourse and representation came into the picture. So political ecology two was the political ecology informed by political economy plus the post-structuralist deconstruction of discourses about nature and culture and so forth. That was political ecology two. Now, political ecology three begins in the last 10 years, maybe, when this post-structuralist political ecology begins to face questions about epistemology, especially ontology, more head-on. And that becomes what Mario Blaser started to call political ontology, which is the label that, for instance, Mario Blaser, Marisol de la Cadena, myself, and other people are using today to talk about political ecology. And maybe I'll say to end that perhaps we can think that there might be a political ecology four, which is beginning to emerge, it has been emerging for a while as well, which focuses in the question of a whole series of questions out of political ontology, especially the question of the human.
Yeah.
The question of how do we inhabit the earth in a different way? So I would say two questions. The questions of the we need a new ontology of the human if we want to face the polycrisis, the terricide, the Anthropocene, and we need to come up with new ways of dwelling on the earth. And this is what is coming out, in my view, from that interface between activist practice that are emphasizing these concerns about the human and the earth and dwelling, and critical academic theory. So that's sort of my trajectory in political ecology.
I have a follow-up question that is not in my schedule interview guide, but then you're raising something here that I am interested in. So as I hear, the fourth political ecology is considering planetary limits in a way, would you say?
Yes, definitely. And it has to. It has to. And it's been there for a while because the question of planetary limits, tipping points, thresholds, has always been there. But the pressure to take these limits seriously into account obviously has been growing rapidly as the evidence about climate change and global warming begins to be more difficult to avoid. And so, for instance, today when people talk about the polycrisis, which is an interaction among many different crises within ecology and beyond ecology, that might produce what are called cascading effects.
Yeah.
And cascading effects are those effects, the results of which will be worse than of any single crisis by itself. The combined effects of this polycrisis will be much worse, and so that the planetary limits are going to be surpassed probably much sooner than we thought. So yes, definitely that's a huge question today in political ecology.
Yes, thank you. And now, following with the guide. So in recent years, your work has turned towards what you refer to being the pluriversal politics. I would like to hear, what do you mean by this term pluriverse, and how does it become activated as a form of politics?
Yes, well, this is another important question today in political ecology, which is this thing about the pluriverse. That came out in Political Ecology 3, really, with political ontology. And this is my own rendition of it. I think political pluriverse has two meanings, two main meanings. The first meaning is, most people agree on that meaning, which basically means a world of many worlds. Or as the Zapatista put it, and for me, and again in Latin America, the main source for this is the Zapatista uprising and how the Zapatista began to emphasize that we don't want to be included into this world, the dominant world, but we want a world where many worlds fit. So a world of many worlds, as Blaser and de la Cadena call it in one of their books, in which I also participated somehow. And so that's the first rendition of the first meaning of the word pluriverse. Going away, trying to go beyond this idea of a world that is made up of a single world, the capitalistic, Western, colonial, heteronormative, patriarchal world, and so forth, whatever you want to call it. How do we go beyond that single world into a world of many worlds? And that's the project of the pluriverse, in ontological, in epistemic and ontological and political and practical terms. But I think there is a second meaning, which for me is becoming increasingly salient and important, which is that the pluriverse also gives an idea of the essence of reality. The essence of reality is this ceaseless changing. Reality is ceaselessly changing and producing forms and patterns and shapes and entities out of the matter and energy that make up the universe. Recently, I've been going back to the work of David Bohm. He's a wonderful physicist that I read when I was in UC Berkeley many years ago. Now it is more meaningful to me because David Bohm, among other things, he's a critic of the mechanistic paradigm in science, in physics in particular, one of the main sort of people working on quantum physics, but also became linked the insights of quantum physics with all kinds of different domains, with Eastern philosophies, with indigenous cosmologies, and so forth. And one of the terms that he uses, is to define kind of the nature of life is the unbroken wholeness, which I think is a beautiful term. We could call it the stream of life as well. So this life is this endless process that is always producing and creating and destroying and doing all the things that we find today, and out of which we come to be who we are from the get-go, from the beginning of the universe to life on Earth to today, in which we are killing the Earth, so to speak, in so many different ways. So that's the second meaning of the pluriverse, again, that we find in some strands of science, from physics to in biology, theories of self-organization and emergence, in Buddhism, the notion of dependent co-arising, in indigenous cosmologies and cosmogonies, the notion of the circularity of life, life as a spiral. I mean, all of those things point to the same aspect that life is that flow and interdependence and relationality, what we call today relationality and interdependence. So that's the second meaning of the pluriverse. And pluriversal politics finally becomes that project of becoming attuned to that idea of life. I'm becoming attuned to the project of moving from trying to, from the globalized world in which only one single way of being, doing, and knowing fits to a world of many worlds.
Yeah.
So that's the quick answer to that question.
That's very interesting. And how do you see then the pluriversal politics being expressed in the context of Latin America, and specifically, for example, in your home country, Colombia?
Yes, almost all of what I've done has been very much influenced and located from and within Latin America, as many people know. And I would say that, let me put it this way, to historicize a bit, doing a little bit of intellectual history. We look at intellectual history of Latin America from the 19th century to today. We find that there have been five pressing questions. The first question, the question of the conquest and the continued impact of the conquest and colonization.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly pressing, as you well know, for indigenous peoples, and in a different way for Afro-descendants. The second question is the question of modernity. Is Latin America modern or is it isn't modern? What is Latin America? And the debates in the 19th century between civilization and barbarism, are we going to choose for civilized Europe as a model, or are we going to stay with indigenous roots and the black roots brought with the people who were enslaved? And that phase culminates, or not culminates because it continues today, but in the 1980s, when Néstor García Canclini writes a book called Culturas Híbridas, Estrategias para Entrar y Salir de la Modernidad, Hybrid Cultures, Strategies for Entering and Exiting Modernity.
Yes.
He rearticulates that question again, saying, what are we Latin Americans if modernity has never really become consolidated, but the traditions are still lingering there and refuse to disappear completely? So what are we? And the third question is the question of US imperialism.
That is
becoming less and less important, but it's still there as a huge question. The fourth question is the question of identities. What is the identity of Latin America? Is Latin America has a single identity or multiple identities?
Yeah.
And that's where the question of the pluriverse begins to come into place. Only then we can say that with the first question, the question of the conquest and colonization, there was the question of the pluriverse was implicit, because indigenous peoples and their resistance have always asserted a pluriverse in a way.
Yeah.
But it wasn't articulated as a pluriversal question by intellectuals. Remember, I'm doing the intellectual history of Latin America, what is called El Pensamiento Crítico Latinoamericano, Latin American Critical Thought, which is a great tradition. In many ways, at the interface between academy and activist practice. And the last question is the question of praxis, which is always in the left, Latin American left, is the question that has informed all the left in the world, really. What do we do? What is to be done? The famous question articulated by, you know, all the great socialists and communists, activists and intellectuals. But the question of identities that begins really in the 1980s and 90s became very important for articulating a different view of Latin America as diverse. That was stained by the discourse of neoliberalism, the discourse of multiculturalism, which became neoliberal, but it refuses to be completely tamed. And I think today there is a much more pluriversal understanding that Latin America is made up of many worlds, of multiple identities that cannot be reduced one to the other. So I would say in Colombia in particular, that was very strong, late 80s, 90s, especially the eruption of Black identities. Indigenous identities had always been there, on and off, coming to the foreground. But in the 90s, Black identities became a huge issue. And the country discovered that it was also a Black country.
Yeah.
A country made of great traditions of African peoples, of Black peoples. So that became a hugely important topic. And today, in Latin American feminisms, Latin American indigenous feminisms, Black feminisms, autonomous feminisms, are also an important part of pluriversal politics as well.
So then, would you say that this has something to do with recognition, for example, or issues of debates about rights and rights of nature, rights of rivers? For example, in my home country, Argentina, there is many indigenous people that is not being recognized as indigenous. And there are normally or casually in areas that are lithium or great interest, and it will brought up a major issue for the state. But yeah, I would like to know if it has to do something with...
Yes, definitely. And I think Black, I learned this mostly from Afro-Colombian activists, which is when they started to mobilize in the Pacific, they started to mobilize on the basis of the rights to difference, the right to difference, the right to have a different culture, and the right to autonomy, autonomy over the territories, the right to their own culture, the right to their own vision of development. But this was cultural rights came after human rights and some sort of social rights and so forth. And now there's an explosion of rights all over the place. And one of the most interesting new domains in which the concept of rights is being explored in theory and in practice is, of course, the one you mentioned, the rights of nature. So, and let me start by giving you a really good example to introduce a concept that we find particularly useful in political ecology and political ontology, which is the concept of pluriversal contact zones. And I will talk about that concept in a moment. But let me introduce it by with an example. The Atrato River, El Rio Atrato, is the third largest river in Colombia, in the Pacific Rainforest region again. It flows towards the Caribbean coast, and it traverses the northern part of the rainforest. And there was a movement that really began in the late 80s, but crystallized only in the last 10 years for the defense of the Atrato River. And the way in which some of the activists, Afro-Colombian activists involved in the movements, explained this movement is they started to emphasize that they had to defend the river, not only because it was an important ecosystem or because it was a source of living or livelihood for fishing and all these things. If that was important, they included that. But also because they couldn't be without the river. They couldn't be without the river. And they emphasize the inseparability between humans and the river, between the Black communities of the rivers and the river. And they use it, they said it very clearly. We are the river. We are not without the river. Somos el río. No podemos existir sin el río. So what I want to highlight here is this non-dualist, as we would call it today, a non-dualist ontology of the river that doesn't abide by the separation between humans and non-humans. And so now, why for the state couldn't understand that. Because for the state, the river is H2O.
A resource. H2O,
or maybe it's an ecosystem that needs to be defended or a source of livelihood for people. But they cannot understand, the state cannot understand this idea that the river is alive. And that we are the river, that we are one with the river. So in the interaction between the state and the communities, there was the creation of what Marisol de la Cadena started to call, we have been developing this concept together, a pluriversal contact zone. So it's a zone space where different ways of knowing, being, and doing, different ontologies, different ways of wording, come together, clash to some extent, to some extent, in understand each other, but in many ways they cannot understand each other because they are speaking from different ontologies.
Yes.
But something interesting happens. And the something interesting that happened was the declaration of the rights of the Atrato rivers. The declaration of the rights of the Atrato River. So the Atrato River as a subject of rights. It's not ideal for the communities. It's not ideal for the state either, because the state then has to begin to create programs of the river and who's going to manage, who's going to be speaking for the river, who are going to be the guardians of the river, etc. So it becomes kind of a nuisance for the state. But nevertheless, it enables the community to advance the struggle over the river as a living entity. So that's why it's a space of negotiation, but it's an ontological negotiation.
It is.
And this is the key concept in political ontology, is that these kinds of environmental problems are often ontological problems. They are not just problems of natural resources or the control of land or the territory or lithium or whatever. They are problems that underline which there's an entirely different conception of life, an entirely different conception of the universe, really, and of Earth, and of the cosmos. The example of lithium is a case in point as well, as you know much better than me, since it is not sort of close to your part of the world, in northern Argentina, el noroeste.
Yes.
in Jujuy, the Los Salares, in Salta Jujuy, and in Chile and in Bolivia. And I recently became aware of the work that I recommend everybody to look into of an Argentinian artist whose name is Tomás Saraceno, who has been developing this concept of aerosin, not anthropocene, but aerosin, like from the air.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting. And one of his main sources of inspiration is the struggles in El Salar, in Jujuy, in Argentina, against lithium mining by the local communities that have been there for hundreds of years, maybe dozens of years, and co-inhabiting and co-creating the Salar with the water, with the salt, with the mountains, with the gods and goddesses, with the animals that they, because they are pastoralist people as well, and like the culturalist.
Yes.
So there's a pluriversal contact zone there in which the power asymmetry is so huge, nevertheless. And this is the question, how do we try to level those power differentials so that the ontological conversation can take place under conditions of greater symmetry?
Thank you. It touches me so much because it is also a very known issue from the area I come from. Furthermore, a recent book of yours is titled Designs of the Pluriverse. So what do you mean by design in this context? Isn't it design, for example, a Western concept? As, for example, planning or development, how can then be appropriated term to use in a connection with this pluriverse, with this several coexisting societies that you mentioned in nature and humans?
Yes. Well, let me start by saying that you're absolutely right that design, like planning and development, are political technologies of modernity. I think that's the best way to describe them, maybe. They have been the means, the tools through which the modern world, the modern ontology, constitutes itself as a world, a dominant world, the world that it has become to be. At the same time, there is a very interesting movement within critical design studies and practice. I emphasize both studies and practice. And design is a very interesting field. I find it fascinating. More interesting maybe in some ways than anthropology or politics or sociology or the formal disciplines. Because because it cannot avoid thinking about the practice because it's so involved in practice. We in the disciplines can have the idea that we can reflect critically on everything without becoming really engaged. Of course, many academics become also engaged, which is wonderful. So in design, critical design studies, there is a move to go beyond design as a just an expert form of knowledge that you obtain by going to design school, to understanding design as something that really everybody does. Everybody is a designer. So that's one of the slogans of contemporary critical design. Design when everybody designs. What does become of design? Design becomes a practice for making life, for thinking about life, and for constructing the world. So that's what design is some of design. Most of design will continue to be what it is, the design of objects and products, and graphic design, and fashion design, industrial design, all of the different things, but that's not going to disappear. But more and more, there's a search for a non-anthropocentric design, a design that really is designed with nature, beyond the nature-culture division, beyond the human and non-human dualism, to become a relational kind of design, a design from interdependence, from the inside of interdependence and regeneration of life. So that's an ontological reorientation of design that is taking different forms in the global north and in the global south. And that would be a different conversation that would be of interest to designers in particular, but probably to everybody else. Out of that, those trends that include in the global south, decolonizing design, decolonial design, altered design, autonomous design, design with other names, designs from the south. So there's a richness in the debate about design. And design, understanding design as a capacity to make life. So like every community practices the design of itself and every person in a way. As Marx would add, not on the conditions of our own choosing, but that's the point.
Yes.
How do we develop a praxis of designing, especially designing as a verb? We're trying to move away from using design as a noun to using design as a process, as a verb, as something you do to make life together, collectively, individually too, but especially collectively.
I see.
So designs for the pluriverse becomes this idea of designing for and from interdependence. Design for and from the notion that the world is multiple, that the world and life is open-ended and it's always changing. And that within that, we can think about strengthening the ability to localize and recommunalize and relocalize our activities through autonomous forms of designing. And that there is something important in that idea. And if we see the practice of many communities that are struggling to defend their communities and their territories, in some sense at least, we can say that they are trying to design the conditions of their own existence, the conditions for pre-existence, as many of the communities in Latin America put it. So I think that, and let me just mention briefly, finally, that we just finished a book. It's a new book that will not come out until January of next year. With two close friends and colleagues, Michal Osterweil and Kriti Sharma. Michal, she teaches in global studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Kriti Sharma is a biologist at Caltech, California Institute of Technology, but is going to be moved into UC Santa Cruz as an assistant professor. And the book is centered on the idea of relationality and interdependence as a different foundation for life. The argument I'm making is that the foundation of life is not separation, as with modernity, but it really is relationality, interdependence, interbeing. And if we take that insight seriously, then we really have to redesign our lives and our worlds. So that's in a way what the book, the new book, is about.
I see. Thank you. Do you have time to one more question?
Let's do the final question with a brief accent answer, maybe.
Yeah. Well, and to wrap up this very rich interview, I had a final question. So where would you say your work is positioned within wider debates regarding post-humanism, such as Bruno Latour, hybrid, or Donna Haraway, or decolonization, such as expressed by Mignolo, Dussel, or Membe. Sorry.
Great. Okay. Yes. I think that, and this, I'm not sure where this started, but certainly with, well, let's not worry about when it started, but we can say that there is a problematization of the mm-hmm. human and of life that has become very important mm-hmm. in the social sciences and the humanities, sometimes in the sciences even, and that have been going on for several decades. Mm. And that is connected to questions that activists are also asking in many different domains of life, not only climate change activists, justice mm. activists, indigenous activists, and feminist activists, and so forth. So what is life and what is the human that we're talking mm. about? And that has been producing a whole set of inquiries mm. and new framings of this question. Some people talk about anti-humanism, post-humanism, transhumanism, counter-humanism, mm. and they are somewhat different. And it doesn't matter, we don't have to get into the differences between these different tendencies, mm-hmm. but to say that in my mind, in most of these, especially in the global north, in the academies in the global north, the academy in the global north, the debates still are very much restricted to the modern terms of the debate, the modern ontology of the human. Hmm. So it is done by modern social sciences, modern social theory about the modern human. But as we can see, and many, many people from, especially in this case, I think, the Black radical traditions, mm-hmm. In the US, in Africa, in Europe, in Latin America, have been very eloquent mm-hmm. at suggesting that we need to face the question, what kind of human are we talking about?
Yes.
That the human that most scholars in the post-humanist discourse are talking about is not the human that has been enslaved and subordinated and marginalized and colonized. Mm. That those debates do not speak to them in the same way because they have a very different experience and a very different consciousness about the human. Mm-hmm. And I think that's super important. And I think one of the best articulations of that question mm. is by Jamaican philosopher Sylvia Winter, when she, and this would be a much longer story to tell you mm-hmm. her story, and is mm-hmm. in our this new book that I mentioned, we deal at length with her argument about how in the modern West developed this monohumanist notion of the human. That's the way she calls it. The human as naturally liberal, secular, bourgeois, individualistic, competitive, rational, instrumental, all these different things. All this idea about how the human is and should be that we take for granted, that have a very specific genealogy in 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century Europe, European intellectual social history, that produce what she calls a bioeconomic notion of man, a bioeconomic man. This man that is competitive and individualistic and aggressive and all these different things, and how we should move beyond that mm-hmm. to what she calls an ecumenical hybrid view of the human, a human that creates herself and himself out of biology and narrative, that is not only about your biological being, but also homo narrans, a human that narrates, the homo narrating, the narrating homo, the narrating human, and how we need to re-narrate the human in a way pluriversally. So how do we come up with multiple visions of the human? There is a Brazilian indigenous intellectual from the Amazon whose name is Ailton Krenak. That even muses about, this wonderful, wonderful thinker, very radical, muses about the possibility of us thinking about the human today in terms of becoming ex-human. And what he means that, so ex-humanism would be fascinating. Not just be, you know, stop being the kind of humans that we have been, that we have been told to be through the tradition of Western modernity, to becoming a more pluriversal kind of human being, obviously much more integrated with the natural world, with the long, long, much longer history of the human, the history of the human worldwide, in Africa, in Asia, in Europe, in Latin America, was a much more embedded, we know that, embedded in territory and in nature and in gods and in the cosmos.
I see.
So going beyond the hiatus, the modern hiatus of the last 500 years, or something else, but that is going to be a new ontology of the human that also believes that they live in the cosmos that is alive, in a living cosmos, and hence that finally is able to construct new ways of dwelling on the earth that are mutually enhancing for humans and for the earth. So that's what I would say to conclude.
Wow, amazing. Amazing conclusion, and it brings hope, it brings a sense of hope and a sense of an academic movement that attempts more than just the debate between academics, but it's something, as I see, wider and much bigger. And I want to thank you, Arturo, for bringing all these insights and for providing me this interview. It's very important for the podcast, but also for everybody that wants to listen and wants to hear about an alternative in these times that is overlapping crisis and overlapping discourses all the time, anxiety. So thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you. No, thank you, Carmen, and to the program for the interview. And yes, we need to be hopeful and have active hope.
Yes.
Hope that comes from engaging with, going beyond critique and engaging with active practices and struggle, wherever we are.
Yes. Yes.
Our way, in Senegal, wherever we are. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is the Political Ecology Forum podcast at the Norwegian University of Life Sciences. I am your host, Carmen Mappis, PhD candidate at the Department of Urban and Regional Planning.